Rain fell over Belgrave House the night Lady Margaret Stirling decided her younger daughter no longer deserved a name. Victoria knelt in the mud beyond the iron gates, soaked to the bone, her wrists raw from where the servants had gripped her, her chest heaving with the kind of silence a girl learns when no one has ever wanted to hear her cry. Above her, candlelight glowed warm and golden in every window of the house that had once been her father's, the house she had cleaned, scrubbed and bled for since the day he died. She had been told, again and again, that she was a mistake. Tonight, her mother had finally found the excuse to make that mistake disappear. Then, through the curtain of rain, she heard it. The slow creak of carriage wheels, the snort of a horse drawing to a stop, a door, black as midnight and trimmed in gold, swinging open. A man stepped down, tall, still, dressed in a coat the color of the moon, his face unreadable, his eyes finding her in the mud as though he had been searching for her his whole life. He said only four words, "Come inside, Miss Stirling." Victoria did not yet know that those four words would unravel a secret buried for 9 years, expose a fraud that could topple three noble houses, and awaken a heart that had sworn, long ago, to never beat for anyone again. This is her story. Greetings, dear viewers. Your support has brought this channel farther than I ever imagined, and we are so grateful. If you enjoy these tales of old Victorian England, do well to subscribe, leave a like, tell us where in the world you are listening from, the time and the day, and support us in ways that you can. Thank you so much. Now then, let us go back to our story. Belgrave House stood 3 miles outside London, a grey stone manor wrapped in ivy and old money. The kind of house that photographed beautifully and hid everything ugly behind its curtains. Victoria Stirling had grown up inside those curtains. She was 18 years old, with her father's dark eyes and a quiet way of moving through rooms as though she did not wish to be noticed in them. She had learned long ago that being noticed in this house was never safe. Her father, Charles Stirling, had died when she was 9. She remembered him only in fragments. The smell of pipe tobacco, a low laugh, a hand resting on her head when no one else was watching. After he was gone, Lady Margaret Stirling, his second wife, had stopped pretending to love her. "You eat my food," Margaret told her once, when Victoria was barely 12, "and you sleep under my roof, and you dare to ask for new shoes? You are not my daughter. You are a debt I am still paying." Victoria had learned to disappear after that. She mended her own dresses. She ate what was left after the kitchen finished feeding the family. She called Charlotte, her half-sister, by her proper name, and never once complained when Charlotte was given new gowns, new ribbons, new tutors, while Victoria scrubbed floors with hands that had once, long ago, played piano under her father's proud gaze. Margaret never called her by her name. To Margaret, she was always something smaller, something easier to discard. The mistake, Margaret called her, in front of guests, in front of servants, in front of Charlotte, who would laugh behind her gloved hand as though it were the cleverest joke in London. Victoria told herself every night that this was simply how things were. She told herself that her father had loved her once, and that love did not vanish simply because the man who gave it was gone. She told herself many things in the dark, because in the daylight, Belgrave House gave her nothing to believe in. She kept one memory of him close, turning it over the way other girls might turn over a treasured stone. She had been 6 years old, perched on her father's knee in his study, watching him sign letters by candlelight, when he had stopped and looked at her with an expression she did not fully understand until much later in life. "Whatever happens to me, Victoria," he had said, "this house is yours. Remember that. No matter what anyone tells you, you are not a guest in your own life." She had not understood, at 6, why he said it with such gravity. She had carried the words anyway, through 9 years of cruelty, like a small flame cupped carefully against the wind, never entirely certain it would not go out. That morning, the morning everything changed, Victoria woke before dawn to lay the fires, as she always did. Her hands were chapped from cold water. Her stomach was empty. She moved through the house like a ghost who had forgotten she was allowed to want things. It was Charlotte who found the missing jewelry first, or said she did. A sapphire brooch, gone from Margaret's dressing table, gone without explanation. "She took it," Charlotte announced at breakfast, her voice dripping with satisfaction. "I saw her near Mother's room only yesterday. Victoria had not been near that room in a week." She said so, calmly, the way she always tried to say things, without anger, because anger only ever made things worse for her. Margaret did not ask questions. She ordered the servants to search Victoria's room, to tear apart the small space under the stairs where Victoria slept, to empty her single trunk onto the floor. They found nothing. There was nothing to find. Charlotte watched from the doorway throughout the search, arms crossed, an odd, satisfied tilt to her chin as servants emptied Victoria's few possessions onto the cold floor, a worn hairbrush, 2 patched dresses, a small bundle of letters her father had once written her, now scattered and trampled beneath careless boots. "Careful with those," Victoria said quietly, kneeling to gather the letters before they could be ruined entirely. "Why?" Charlotte asked, almost curious despite herself. "They are only paper." "They are all I have left of him," Victoria said, and something in her voice made even Charlotte fall silent for a moment, before her mother's voice called impatiently from the hall, and she turned away without another word. It did not matter. "She has hidden it somewhere," Margaret said, her face cold as the rain that had begun to tap against the windows. "Or sold it. Either way, I am finished. I am finished pretending you belong in this family, Victoria. You have taken enough from me." "I took nothing," Victoria said. Her voice shook, but she did not look away. "I have never taken anything from you, Lady Margaret. Not even what was rightfully mine." Something flickered across Margaret's face at those words, not guilt, but something colder. Fear, perhaps, quickly buried beneath fury. "Get her out," Margaret told the footman. "Tonight. In this rain, if that is what it takes. I want her gone before Charlotte's engagement dinner tomorrow. I will not have a thief sitting at my table." Victoria did not beg. She had learned, in this house, that begging changed nothing. She gathered the one shawl she owned, the one that had belonged to her mother, her real mother, who had died bringing her into the world, and she walked out into the rain with her chin lifted, even as her heart cracked quietly inside her chest. Margaret followed her to the gates herself, as though she could not trust the servants to finish the cruelty properly. The rain soaked through Margaret's silk wrap, and still she did not stop. "You are no longer my daughter," Margaret said, her voice carrying over the storm. "You never were. Do you understand me, girl? Whatever claim you imagined you had to this house, to your father's name, it ends tonight." Victoria fell to her knees in the mud beyond the gates. Not because her legs failed her, but because for one moment, the full weight of 9 years of unwantedness pressed down on her all at once, and she could not stand beneath it. The rain hid the tears she no longer wished anyone to count. She did not see the carriage approach. She only heard it, the rhythm of hooves slowing, the creak of wheels, the particular hush that falls when something important is about to happen, even before anyone understands why. A door opened, black, trimmed in gold, lit faintly from within by a single lantern swinging on its hook. A man stepped down into the rain as though the weather meant nothing to him at all. He was tall, dressed simply but richly, his dark hair plastered to his forehead by the storm, his face composed in the particular stillness of a man who had long ago decided that showing nothing was safer than showing everything. His eyes found her in the mud, and something in them sharpened, though his voice, when he spoke, remained level. "Lady Margaret." He inclined his head toward her, the barest courtesy. "I did not expect to find you discarding family property in the street." Margaret's spine went rigid. "Your Grace, this does not concern you. The girl is no one, a servant's child we took in out of charity." "She is Charles Sterling's daughter," the man said, and the words landed like a verdict. "I knew her father. I do not believe charity describes what I am looking at." Margaret's mouth opened, then closed. Whatever she might have said, she swallowed it. The man turned from her entirely, as though she had already ceased to exist, and looked down at Victoria, who knelt in the mud with rain running down her face, unable to speak. He extended his hand, not with pity, with something steadier than pity. "Come inside, Miss Sterling." Victoria stared up at him, at the carriage door open behind him, like a question she had not known she was allowed to answer. "Who are you?" she whispered. "William," he said, "Duke of Thornfield. And you, I think, have been kneeling in this rain long enough." She did not know, as she placed her trembling hand into his and let him draw her up out of the mud, that this single gesture would alter the fate of two ancient families, unearth a fraud that had slept for 9 years, and begin a love that neither of them, in their wildest imaginings, believed themselves capable of surviving. The carriage rocked gently along the dark road, lantern light swimming across William's still face as Victoria sat across from him, dripping rainwater onto cushions, finer than anything she had touched in years. She did not speak. She did not know what to say to a duke who had appeared out of a storm as though summoned by it. William did not speak either, not at first. He simply watched her in the careful, measured way of a man accustomed to studying people before trusting them with words. "You knew my father," Victoria finally said, because the silence had become heavier than the rain outside. "I did." William's voice was quiet, but it did not invite further questions. "Not yet. Charles Sterling was a good man, a rare thing among men of his class. He died when I was 9. I know." Something passed behind William's eyes, gone before she could name it. "I am sorry for that loss. More sorry, perhaps, than you understand tonight." She wanted to ask what he meant. She was too tired, too cold, too unraveled by the events of the evening to push further. She let her head rest against the carriage window instead, watching the dark countryside blur past, and did not realize she had fallen asleep until the carriage stopped, and William's voice, low and careful, woke her. "We have arrived." Thornfield Hall rose out of the darkness like something carved from the night itself, vast, grey stone, towers catching what little moonlight slipped between the clouds, dozens of windows glowing with warm lamplight. It was larger than Belgrave House. It felt, somehow, far less cold, despite its master's reputation. A butler met them at the door, an older man with silver hair and sharp, knowing eyes, that took in Victoria's ruined dress and bare, muddy feet without a flicker of judgment. "Mrs. Whitfield will see to her," the butler said, already gesturing for a housekeeper. A bath, dry clothes, and the blue guest room, Your Grace. Yes, Hawthorne, see that she is comfortable. William's gaze flicked once more to Victoria, something almost gentle beneath the careful distance he kept. You are safe here, Miss Sterling. No one will harm you under this roof. Why? Victoria asked, the question escaping before she could stop it. Why would you do this for someone you do not know? William's jaw tightened, just slightly. Rest tonight. There will be time enough for explanations. He turned and walked away before she could press further, his boots echoing against marble floors, leaving her standing in the warm light of a stranger's hall, wondering what kind of man rescued a girl from the mud and then refused to say why. The days that followed unfolded slowly, like a held breath finally released. Mrs. Whitfield, the housekeeper, was kind in a brisk, practical way that reminded Victoria, painfully, of what a mother might have been. She brought Victoria dresses that fit properly, fed her food that did not arrive as scraps, and asked no questions that Victoria was not ready to answer. William kept his distance. He took his meals alone, in his study, surrounded by ledgers and letters that he locked away the moment anyone entered the room. The servants spoke of him in careful tones, not unkindly, but with the particular wariness people reserve for a man they have never seen smile. He has not always been so closed off, Hawthorne told Victoria one afternoon, as she sat reading in the library, sunlight falling warm across old leather chairs. Something happened to him years ago. He does not speak of it. None of us ask. What happened? Hawthorne's expression softened, but he shook his head. That is his to tell, Miss Sterling, should he ever choose to. Victoria found herself thinking of William more than she wished to admit. She told herself it was curiosity, nothing more. The natural wondering one might have toward a man who had pulled her from the mud and then vanished behind locked doors. She told herself this each time she noticed the particular shape of his hands when he poured tea, or the low, careful sound of his voice when he spoke to his staff. Never raised, never cruel, even when correcting a mistake. She told herself many things in those first weeks at Thornfield, and most of them were not entirely true. There was a particular evening, early in her second week, when William found her standing in the entrance hall during a sudden downpour, watching the rain through the tall windows, with an expression he could not quite read. Does the rain trouble you? He asked, coming to stand a careful distance away. It used to mean only one thing to me, Victoria admitted. Cold. Punishment. The sound of being sent away. I am trying to teach myself it can mean other things now. Without a word, William removed his own coat and settled it gently over her shoulders, though the hall itself was warm and she had no true need of it. The gesture said what neither of them was yet prepared to say aloud, that he had noticed her shivering, even when the cold came from somewhere far older than the weather, and that he wished, in whatever small way he could, to keep her from feeling it again. Perhaps, he said quietly, it can mean this instead. Victoria did not trust herself to answer. She only drew the coat closer, breathing in the faint scent of cedar and rain that clung to it, and felt something in her chest loosen that had been clenched tight for as long as she could remember. It became, after that night, a quiet habit between them. Small kindnesses offered without ceremony, accepted without protest. He began noticing the particular tea she favored, and ensured it was always poured first. She began noticing the way his shoulders eased, almost imperceptibly, whenever she entered a room he occupied, as though some part of him had been holding its breath until she arrived. Hawthorne, who missed very little that occurred beneath his master's roof, observed the pattern with the quiet satisfaction of a man who had waited a long while to see it. His Grace has not smiled this often in a decade, Miss Sterling, the old butler confided one afternoon, polishing silver with unnecessary thoroughness. I dare say the staff have taken to wagering on how long it will be before he admits why. There is nothing to admit, Hawthorne, Victoria said, though heat rose to her cheeks even as she said it. Of course, Miss Sterling. Hawthorne's eyes glinted with something close to mischief. Whatever you say. It was in the library, 3 weeks into her stay, that she first found him without his usual armor in place. She had wandered down past midnight, unable to sleep, drawn by the soft glow of candlelight beneath the library door. She expected to find it empty. Instead, she found William, seated by the dying fire, a glass of brandy untouched at his elbow, his head bowed over an old letter, his shoulders carrying a weight she hadn't seen him carry in daylight. Forgive me, she whispered, already turning to leave. I did not mean to intrude. Stay. The word came out low, almost surprised at itself. William looked up, and for the first time, Victoria saw something unguarded in his face. Not quite pain, but its close cousin. I find I do not wish to be alone tonight, Miss Sterling, though I could not tell you why. She hesitated, then crossed the room and sat across from him, the fire casting gold light over both their faces. You knew my father well, she said, gently testing the door she had not yet been permitted through. Will you tell me how? William was quiet for a long moment, turning the letter over in his hands. Your father came to me 9 years ago. He believed certain men in this country, men with titles, men with reputations to protect, were committing a fraud large enough to ruin half the families who trusted them with their fortunes. He asked for my help investigating it. Victoria's breath caught. And did you help him? I tried. William's voice roughened, just slightly. Before we finished, your father disappeared. The official story was an accident, a fall from his horse, alone, on a road he had ridden 100 times before. You do not believe that story? No. William met her eyes fully now, something fierce burning beneath his careful stillness. I have spent 9 years trying to prove it false, Victoria. I have watched Belgrave House from a careful distance for months, waiting for the right moment to act, because I believe your father hid evidence there before he died. Evidence that could expose the men responsible. Victoria sat very still, the fire crackling between them, her mind turning over every cold word her mother had ever spoken to her, in a new and terrible light. Is that why you came that night? Because of the evidence? Not because of me? Something shifted in William's expression. Guilt, perhaps, or its careful cousin. I came because I had been watching the house. Yes. I will not lie to you about that. But the moment I saw you kneeling in that rain, Victoria, whatever I had planned to do that night no longer mattered. I could not leave you there. Whatever else is true, that much was never calculation. It should have angered her, perhaps, to learn that his arrival had not been pure rescue, that it had been tangled up in old secrets and older grief. Instead, she found herself oddly steadied by his honesty, by the plain, unflinching way he had given her the truth rather than a softer lie. Then we are both searching for something, she said quietly. You for the men who took my father. And I, her voice caught, for the reason my own mother decided I was never worth keeping. William's eyes held hers, something warm and careful kindling behind the grief. Perhaps, Miss Sterling, we search better together than alone. Neither of them moved to close the distance between their chairs that night. But something had shifted nonetheless. A door left open, just slightly, where before there had been only locked rooms and careful silence. There was a small gathering at Thornfield not long after, a modest dinner William hosted for two neighbouring families he could not politely avoid. Victoria attended at his quiet insistence, dressed in deep blue silk that Mrs. Whitfield had insisted suited her far better than anything Belgrave House had ever offered her. When the evening's music began, William crossed the room without a word and simply held out his hand. "I do not dance well," Victoria admitted, even as she placed her hand in his. "Neither do I," William said, drawing her gently into the steps. "We shall simply have to be poor at it together." They were not poor at it. They moved through the steps with a careful, unhurried grace. William's hand warm at her waist, Victoria's breath catching each time their eyes met and held a fraction longer than the dance required. Neither of them spoke. Words in that moment felt entirely unnecessary, almost dangerous, as though speaking aloud might shatter whatever fragile, charged thing was building quietly between them with every turn. When the music ended, William did not immediately release her hand. "Victoria," he said, low enough that only she could hear it, and then seemed to think better of whatever he had meant to say next. He only pressed her fingers once, briefly, before stepping back into the safer distance he kept so carefully rationed. She felt the warmth of that single pressed touch long after the candles had been put out that night. Autumn settled over Thornfield in shades of amber and rust, and with it came a strange, fragile comfort that Victoria had never known in all her years of living. She rose each morning without fear of what cruelty the day might bring. She ate without watching the door for her mother's temper. She read in the library without flinching when footsteps approached. Slowly, carefully, she began to remember what it felt like to simply exist in a room without needing to make herself smaller in it. William noticed the change, though he said little about it directly. He began joining her for tea in the late afternoons, a habit that started, he claimed, purely out of convenience, since his study adjoined the small sitting room she favored. "You do not need to explain yourself to me, Your Grace," Victoria told him once, amusement tugging at the corner of her mouth. "I have noticed you arrive at precisely 4 o'clock every day for a fortnight now. Convenience rarely keeps such an exact schedule." A faint, almost startled smile crossed William's face, gone as quickly as it appeared, but real. "You are observant, Miss Stirling." "I have had a great deal of practice watching people closely," Victoria said, quieter now. "It is, perhaps, the one skill my mother's house gave me freely." William's jaw tightened at the mention of Margaret, though he said nothing. Instead, his gaze dropped, almost unconsciously, to the small pendant Victoria wore at her throat. A simple, silver locket, worn smooth with age, that she had kept since childhood and never once removed. "Where did you get that?" he asked, his voice oddly careful. Victoria's hand rose instinctively to touch it. "I do not remember receiving it. It has simply always been mine, for as long as I can recall. I assumed, when I was old enough to wonder, that it must have come from my father, though he never once spoke of it." William rose from his chair, crossing to where she sat, and for a long moment simply studied the small locket without touching it. "May I see it closer?" She unclasped it and placed it in his open palm. He turned it over carefully, his thumb tracing the small engraved initials on its back, a single letter V, intertwined with a smaller W, so faded with age that Victoria herself had never noticed it. "This was a pair," William said slowly, as though pulling the memory up from somewhere deep and long buried. "My mother had two made before she died, meaning for me to give the second to a friend's child as a token of goodwill between our two houses. I believe now that friend's child was you. I lost mine years ago. I never thought to wonder what became of its match, until tonight. Victoria stared at him. You believe we have met before? I believe, William said, his voice unusually rough, that we met as children, at some gathering neither of us remembers, and that fate has apparently decided we were not finished with each other. Something warm and unsteady moved through Victoria's chest at the thought that some small, forgotten version of herself had once stood near some small, forgotten version of him, long before either of them carried the weight they carried now. That night, lying awake long after the candles had been snuffed, Victoria found herself reaching for a memory she had never thought to search for before. A garden, somewhere green and sunlit, a boy with serious eyes who had given a small girl a silver locket and told her, with the solemn formality only children manage, that it would keep her safe wherever she went. She had not remembered his face. She wondered now whether some part of her had been carrying him all along, buried beneath everything that came after. She rose before dawn the next morning and found William already awake in the breakfast room, a cup of tea, cooling, untouched before him. I dreamed of a garden last night, she said, before she had fully decided to say it at all. I do not know if it was a true memory or only a wish dressed as one. William's gaze lifted to hers, something quiet and aching behind his composure. I have dreamed of that same garden for as long as I can remember, Victoria, and never once known why it haunted me the way it did. I believe now I was dreaming of you. The air between them seemed to draw taut, charged with something neither of them had yet named. Victoria crossed the room slowly, drawn by an instinct stronger than caution, and stopped close enough that she could feel the warmth radiating from him, close enough to see the faint, betraying catch in his breath. Does that frighten you? She asked softly. No. William's eyes, when they met hers, held none of their usual careful distance. It is, perhaps, the first thing in a very long while that has not frightened me at all. His hand rose, slowly, as though he might brush the hair from her cheek as he had once before, and this time he did not stop himself halfway. His fingers traced the line of her jaw with a tenderness that made her breath catch entirely, his gaze dropping briefly to her mouth before lifting again, asking a question he would not yet allow himself to voice aloud. William, she whispered, his name a plea and a warning both, for she did not trust herself to remain steady if he leaned even an inch closer. He understood. He always seemed to understand the things she could not say plainly. He withdrew his hand, though slowly, reluctantly, as though it cost him something to do it. Forgive me, he murmured. I find myself wanting things I have no right to want yet. Perhaps, Victoria said, her voice unsteady. I do not mind being wanted, William. Not by you. It was as far as either of them dared go that night. But the air in the room had changed, charged now with a hunger neither of them spoke of openly, a slow-burning ache that followed them both up the stairs and lingered long after their separate doors had closed. It was 2 days later that the solicitor came. Mr. Edmund Faulkner had served as the Stirling family's man of business for over 20 years, a quiet, careful man with ink-stained fingers and a reputation for discretion. He arrived at Thornfield unannounced, his face pale, his hands trembling as Hawthorne showed him into William's study. Victoria was summoned soon after. Miss Stirling, Faulkner's voice shook as he spoke, his eyes darting toward the study door as though he expected someone to burst through it. I have kept something from you for far too long. I convinced myself it was for your protection. I see now that silence has only ever protected the wrong people. He withdrew a thick folio from his coat, its edges worn soft with handling, and placed it on William's desk with hands that would not steady. Your father did not die, intestate, Miss Sterling. He left the whole of Belgrave House, its lands, and the better part of his fortune, to you. Lady Margaret was granted only a widow's allowance, and Charlotte nothing beyond a modest dowry already settled before your father's death. Victoria's breath left her in a sharp, disbelieving rush. That cannot be true. Margaret has run that house as though it were entirely hers for 9 years. She has run it illegally, Faulkner said, his voice gaining a thin, frightened steadiness. I was meant to reveal the will the moment you came of age. I did not, because Lady Margaret threatened to ruin my reputation, my livelihood, perhaps worse, should I do so. I am ashamed to admit how easily that threat silenced me. Why come forward now? William asked, his voice carrying the particular sharpness Victoria had learned meant he suspected more beneath the surface. Faulkner's hands twisted together. Because I am being followed, Your Grace. I believe someone has discovered that I hold documents which would unravel a great deal more than one family's inheritance. I fear I will not have the chance to reveal everything, if I wait much longer. Then reveal it now, William said. Whatever you know. But Faulkner only shook his head, fear overtaking him fully. Not all of it. Not yet. I must retrieve the remaining papers from a safe location first. Papers that name men far more dangerous than Lady Margaret. Give me 3 days. I will return with everything. He left Thornfield that same evening, the folio of Victoria's inheritance left behind for safekeeping, his promise of 3 days hanging unfulfilled in the autumn air. Victoria stood at the window long after his carriage had disappeared down the drive, watching the last grey light fade over the hills. I do not like this, she said quietly. Everything he said felt like a man saying goodbye, though he did not mean to. William came to stand beside her, his presence steady against the unease settling cold in her chest. We will not lose him to silence the way I lost your father, Victoria. I promise you that much. She turned to look at him, struck by the quiet fierceness in his voice, and found herself, for the first time, fully believing that promise, rather than simply hoping it might be true. She thought, in that quiet moment by the window, of how strange it was that a man who guarded his own heart so carefully had no hesitation at all in defending hers. It was, she realized, a particular kind of courage. Not the loud, easy courage of men who never doubted themselves, but the harder, quieter kind that came from a man who had been wounded badly and chosen, despite it, to keep offering his protection to someone else. Thank you, she said softly, for not letting this house become another place where I learn to expect the worst. William's hand found hers in the fading light, his fingers warm and certain around her own. You will never need to expect the worst again, Victoria. Not while I am the one standing beside you. Edmund Faulkner was never seen again. Faulkner's disappearance settled over Thornfield like a held breath that would not release. William doubled the watch on the house. He sent inquiries to every magistrate and contact he trusted in London and received nothing but silence and shrugging. Uncertainty in return. Victoria, for her part, found herself unable to sleep through a single night without waking at the smallest sound, her mind circling endlessly around the missing solicitor and the secrets he had carried away with him. It was William who found her one such night, wandering the dark corridor outside her room, unable to settle. You should be resting, he said softly, though he made no move to send her back to bed. I cannot stop thinking of him, Victoria admitted. Mr. Faulkner. He looked so frightened, William. I have never seen a grown man look so afraid. It was the first time she had used his given name without his title attached, and something flickered across his face at the sound of it. Surprise, and beneath that, a warmth he did not bother to hide this time. Say it again, he murmured, before he could stop himself. William, she repeated, quieter now, and watched the careful distance he kept so faithfully soften, just for a moment, into something far more dangerous to them both. He reached out, slowly, and brushed a strand of hair from her face, his fingers lingering a heartbeat longer than propriety would ever permit. Neither of them moved away. I am frightened too, Victoria whispered. Not only for Mr. Faulkner, for what this all means, for what happens when the truth finally comes out. Whatever comes, William said, his voice low and rough, I do not intend to let it take you from me. Not now. It was as close to a confession as either of them had allowed themselves, and for a long, breathless moment, the corridor held nothing but the sound of their unsteady breathing and the unspoken question of how much closer either of them was willing to lean. Will you tell me why you became this way? Victoria asked quietly. Closed off. Careful with everyone, even your own staff, until they have earned a decade of trust. William's jaw tightened, but he did not turn away from her, as she half expected him to. I had a younger sister once, Eleanor. She trusted a man who claimed to love her, a man our father approved of, a man I myself vouched for. He took her fortune within a year of their marriage and left her with nothing, not even her good name. I was meant to protect her, Victoria, and I failed entirely. She died 2 winters later, in a house I was too proud and too late to reach in time. Victoria's chest ached at the rawness in his voice, at the guilt he had clearly carried alone for years. That was not your failure to carry, William. That belonged to the man who deceived her. I have told myself that 1,000 times, William admitted. I have never once believed it fully. So I closed every door after that. I told myself distance was safer than ever, risking that failure again, with anyone. And now? Victoria asked softly. Now, William said, his voice rough with something he had clearly been fighting for weeks. I find distance has become the heavier burden of the two. Then a floorboard creaked, somewhere down the hall, and William stepped back with the discipline of a man long practiced in denying himself what he wanted most. Go to bed, Victoria, he said gently. Please, I will not rest easy until I know you are safe behind a locked door tonight. The spy revealed himself 3 nights later, though not in the manner anyone expected. William had grown suspicious of certain small things. Letters that arrived opened and resealed, a study door found unlocked when he was certain he had locked it, a conversation with his man of affairs that seemed to reach Lady Margaret's ears with impossible speed. He set a trap accordingly, leaving a false letter on his desk describing a fictitious location where Faulkner's remaining documents were supposedly hidden. By morning, the letter was gone. By evening, a stable hand named Cobb was caught, attempting to slip away from Thornfield's grounds with the false letter folded into his coat. Who pays you? William demanded, his voice colder than Victoria had ever heard it, as 2 footmen held the trembling stable hand in the courtyard. Cobb did not last long under that particular cold fury. Lady Margaret, Your Grace. She has paid me since the lady arrived here. She wanted to know everything, where the documents were kept, who came and went, whether Miss Sterling and yourself were. He faltered, glancing nervously toward Victoria. Whether you had grown close, Your Grace. And what did you tell her? That you had, sir. That much was plain to see for anyone in this household. William's jaw tightened, though Victoria thought she saw, beneath the fury, something almost like relief, that whatever grew between them had been visible enough that even a frightened stable hand could not deny it. You will tell me everything you have reported to Lady Margaret, William said, and in exchange, I will not see you hanged for whatever role you played in Mr. Faulkner's disappearance. Cobb's confession, given in halting, fearful pieces over the following hour, revealed a name neither William nor Victoria expected. Not merely Lady Margaret, working alone, but a man behind her. A man whose instructions she followed as faithfully as Cobb followed hers. Lord Desmond Kensington. Kensington, William repeated, something dark passing behind his eyes. I should have suspected him from the beginning. You know him? Victoria asked. Everyone in London knows him, William said grimly. He sits on 3 different charitable boards, dines with half the peerage, and has spent 20 years building a reputation as the most respectable man in England. I begin to suspect that reputation was always the most carefully constructed lie of all. That night, once the household had finally settled and Cobb had been handed over to a magistrate, William trusted to keep quiet until the larger scheme could be fully exposed, Victoria found William still awake in his study, staring at nothing in particular. You are blaming yourself, she said. Not as a question. I should have noticed sooner, William admitted. A man was lost under my own roof, gathering information meant to hurt you, and I did not see it until it was nearly too late. You saw it in time, Victoria said gently, crossing to stand beside his chair. That is not nothing, William. That is, in fact, rather a great deal. He reached for her hand, without quite seeming to decide to do so, and for a long while they simply sat together in comfortable silence, the fire low, the house finally quiet around them, both of them aware that whatever came next, they would not face it alone. Mrs. Whitfield, passing the study door sometime past midnight on her usual rounds, paused only long enough to note the sight with quiet satisfaction before continuing on her way, humming softly to herself. What followed was a careful, dangerous unraveling. William spent long nights in his study, poring over the documents recovered from Faulkner's office, cross-referencing names, dates, and figures against records he had gathered quietly over the preceding 9 years. Victoria often sat with him through those hours, not merely as company, but as a careful second set of eyes, her sharp memory for detail proving more useful than William had expected. Your father's handwriting changes here, she observed one night, pointing to a column of figures in an old ledger. Look, these entries are pressed harder into the page, as though he were angry or frightened when he wrote them. William studied the page closely, then looked up at her with something like wonder. I have read this ledger 12 times and never once noticed that. You see things I have trained myself to overlook, Victoria. I spent years learning to notice the smallest changes in a room, she said quietly. It was, for a long while, the only way I knew to keep myself safe. It was that very habit of careful noticing that led her, 2 nights later, to recognize a particular seal pressed into the corner of 1 falsified account, a seal she had seen before, stamped onto letters that arrived at Belgrave House, addressed only to her mother, always delivered by hand, always burned in the fireplace within the hour. Kensington, she said softly, the name settling into place. I saw his seal 100 times, and never once thought to question it. William, using contacts gathered over years of quiet investigation, learned that Lord Kensington had spent 2 decades orchestrating a scheme that defrauded 6 noble families of their fortunes, using forged investments and falsified accounts to bleed estates dry while appearing, publicly, to be their most trusted advisor. Charles Sterling had discovered the fraud 9 years earlier and threatened to expose it. Within months, he was dead, and Kensington had ensured, through quiet threats and careful manipulation, that Lady Margaret, desperate to secure the whole of Belgrave House and its fortune for Charlotte, her own daughter, free of any rival claim from her late husband's first family, would cooperate fully in burying the truth in exchange for control of the estate and a steady stream of Kensington's money. She did not hate me because I resembled my father, Victoria said quietly, the pieces finally settling into place as William laid out what he had learned. She hated me because I stood between Charlotte and the only thing Kensington promised her, the whole of this house and fortune, with no rival claim left to challenge it, once I was removed from the inheritance entirely. It explains a great deal, William said gently, though it excuses none of it. No, Victoria agreed, her voice steadier than she expected. It does not. They returned to Belgrave House together, 3 days later, not as the broken girl who had once been cast into the rain, but as a woman armed with Faulkner's recovered folio, found at last, hidden inside a false drawer in his abandoned office, untouched by whoever had taken him, and the quiet, unshakable support of the Duke of Thornfield at her side. Lady Margaret received them in the same drawing room where Victoria had once been accused of theft, her composure brittle but intact. You have no right to return here, Margaret said, though her eyes flickered nervously toward the folio in William's hands. I have every right, Victoria said, and was surprised by how calm her own voice sounded. This house was my father's. He left it to me. You have known that for 9 years, Lady Margaret, and you let me believe I was nothing in a home that was always, legally, mine. You understand nothing of what I sacrificed to keep this family afloat, Margaret snapped, fear sharpening into fury. Do you think it was easy, bowing to that man's demands for 9 years? I understand that you let your daughter believe she was unwanted, William said, his voice carrying a quiet authority that filled the room without need of volume, so that Charlotte, a girl who has likely never once thanked you for it, might inherit a house that was never legally yours to give her. Margaret's mouth opened, then closed, her usual sharp control crumbling under the weight of a truth she had buried for 9 years. It was Charlotte who broke the silence, stepping forward with an expression Victoria had never seen on her half-sister's face before, something closer to shame than triumph. Is it true? Charlotte asked quietly, looking between her mother and Victoria. All of it? You let me believe she was a thief, a burden, nothing, when she was the rightful heir to everything we have? Margaret did not answer. She did not need to. Her silence was answer enough. That evening, before Victoria and William departed Belgrave House, Charlotte found her on the front steps, twisting her gloved hands together with none of her usual sharp confidence. I do not expect you to forgive me, Charlotte said quietly. I said cruel things to you for years, Victoria, and worse, I believed them, because believing them was easier than questioning Mother. I am ashamed of the girl I was. Victoria studied her half-sister for a long moment, searching for the old bitterness she had carried so faithfully for so long, and found, to her own surprise, that it had grown quieter than she expected. I do not know if forgiveness comes all at once, Charlotte, but I am willing to begin finding it, if you are willing to become someone worth forgiving. Charlotte's eyes filled, and for the first time in Victoria's memory, her sister did not try to hide it. I would like that very much. The carriage ride back to Thornfield passed in a comfortable quiet. Victoria's head resting against William's shoulder, his hand resting lightly over hers, neither of them needing words to fill the space between them. The confrontation that followed at Lady Hartwell's autumn gathering, 3 weeks later, was the kind London society would speak of for years afterward. The ballroom that evening glittered with candlelight and gossip in equal measure, every guest aware that something significant was about to unfold, though few understood precisely what. Victoria stood near the long windows in a gown of deep garnet silk, her hand resting lightly on William's arm, steadier than she had ever imagined she could feel beneath the weight of so many watching eyes. "You need not stand so close to the door, Victoria," William murmured, a faint, wry warmth in his voice. "I do not intend to let you flee before the evening is finished." "I was considering it nonetheless," Victoria admitted, a small smile tugging at her, mouth, despite the tension, coiled tight in her chest. "Old habits, Your Grace." "Then allow me to give you a new one," he said quietly. "Stay, and let them see exactly who you are." Margaret had arrived determined to strike first, announcing to a room full of London's most influential families that Victoria Stirling was an impostor, a former servant's daughter, attempting to claim a fortune through forged documents and a duke's misplaced charity. She had not expected William to arrive prepared. He did not raise his voice. He did not need to. He simply stepped forward, opened Faulkner's recovered folio before the assembled crowd, and began, methodically, to lay out 20 years of evidence. The will naming Victoria the rightful heir, witnessed and sealed by 3 separate solicitors, the falsified accounts bearing Kensington's careful signature, the threatening letters Margaret had received and kept, foolishly, rather than destroyed, evidence of her own complicity laid bare in her own handwriting. "You will ruin us," Margaret hissed, her composure finally shattering entirely. "You ruined yourselves," William said quietly, "the moment you decided a child's inheritance was worth less than your own comfort." Lord Kensington, present at the gathering and watching his careful reputation collapse in real time, attempted to flee the room. He did not make it past the front hall, where 2 magistrates William had quietly arranged in advance were waiting to receive him. The room that had gathered to watch Victoria's disgrace instead watched her vindication, piece by careful piece, until even London's sharpest tongues had nothing left to say but her name, spoken now with something closer to respect than pity. Victoria did not gloat. She stood quietly beside William as the truth unfolded, her chin lifted, not in triumph, but in something steadier, the simple, unshakable knowledge that she had never been the mistake everyone insisted she was. Later that night, once the carriages had carried away the last of London's stunned guests, William found Victoria standing alone on Lady Hartwell's terrace, the autumn air cool against her flushed cheeks. "You did not need to say a single word in there," William said, joining her at the railing. "Your silence carried more weight than any defense I could have offered." "I have spent a lifetime being silent for the wrong reasons," Victoria said softly. "It felt strange tonight to finally be silent for the right one." "You are shaking," William observed gently. "I believe," Victoria admitted, a small, disbelieving laugh escaping her, "that I am simply unaccustomed to winning, Your Grace." William's mouth curved into the rare, full smile she had come to treasure more than she dared admit. "Then allow me the privilege of watching you grow accustomed to it. I find I rather enjoy this version of you, the one who no longer flinches when good fortune finally arrives." Hawthorne, observing the pair from a respectful distance near the terrace doors, allowed himself a small, satisfied smile of his own before quietly slipping away to inform Mrs. Whitfield that their wager, whatever its precise terms, was very much settled in her favor. Winter arrived at Thornfield gently, dusting the gardens in soft white, and with it came a quiet that neither Victoria nor William had known they were capable of holding together. Belgrave House was hers now, fully and legally, though Victoria found she had little wish to return to it permanently. Lady Margaret had fled to relations in the north, her reputation in ruins, the inheritance she had schemed for gone with it. Charlotte, surprisingly, had asked to remain at Belgrave under Victoria's care, and Victoria, who understood better than most what it meant to be shaped by a mother's cruelty, had agreed. There had been, in the week since London, a slow and deliberate unravelling of the careful distance William once kept so faithfully. He no longer hesitated to seek her out in the evenings. He no longer pretended his visits to the small sitting room were accidents of convenience. And Victoria, who had spent years learning to want nothing too openly, found herself wanting him with a hunger she had never permitted herself before, in the way his gaze lingered on her mouth when he thought she would not notice, in the warmth that gathered low in her chest whenever his hand found the small of her back to guide her through a doorway, in the breathless ache that settled over her each night long after he had bid her good evening and retreated, with visible reluctance, to his own rooms. One evening, walking the gallery together after dinner, William stopped beneath a portrait of his late mother and turned to face her fully, his eyes dark with something he no longer troubled himself to hide. "You consume my every thought, Victoria," he admitted, his voice low and rough with restraint. "I find myself entirely undone by you, and I am no longer certain I wish to be otherwise." "Then do not fight it," Victoria whispered, closing the distance between them until she could feel the warmth of him, until her hand rose, almost without her own permission, to rest against his chest, where his heart beat unsteady beneath her palm. William's hand covered hers there, holding it gently in place, his forehead dropping to rest against hers, breath mingling in the charged quiet of the gallery. "If I kiss you now," he murmured, "I do not believe I shall manage to stop wanting to again." "Then perhaps," Victoria said softly, "you should stop fighting that as well." He did not kiss her that night. Some final thread of restraint held, born of a wish to do this properly, fully, when nothing stood between them any longer. But the slow, aching promise of it lingered between them for days afterward, a hunger neither of them spoke of, but both of them carried, patient and certain, toward whatever came next. It was William who found her in the library one evening in late December, the fire burning low, snow falling soft and silent beyond the windows. "I have spent years believing I would never risk myself this way again," he said, his voice rough with something he had clearly been carrying toward her for days. "After everyone I trusted proved eventually that trust was a mistake, I told myself it was safer to remain alone." "And now?" Victoria asked softly, setting aside her book. "Now I find I would rather risk everything than spend another winter without you in this house," William said, crossing the room to kneel before her. Not from duty or protocol, but because he wished her to understand, fully, that what he offered was a choice, freely made, not an obligation owed. "I am not asking you to marry a duke because he rescued you from the rain," he said. "I am asking you to marry a man who has watched you become the strongest person he has ever known, and who cannot imagine facing whatever comes next without you walking beside him." Victoria's hands trembled as she reached for his. "You opened a carriage door that night," she whispered, "but what you truly opened was the life I thought had died in that house, long before I ever knelt in the mud beneath it." Their first kiss came slowly, carefully, the culmination of months of restrained longing finally given permission to exist, his hand warm against her jaw, her fingers curling into the lapel of his coat, the fire crackling soft beside them, as though even the room understood it was witnessing something neither of them would ever forget. When at last they parted, breathless, foreheads still resting together, William let out a low, unsteady laugh, as though he could hardly believe he had been permitted such happiness after so many years spent guarding himself against it. "I have waited a very long time to feel like this," he murmured against her hair. "I find I have no wish to wait a moment longer for the rest of it." "Then do not," Victoria whispered back, and felt, for the first time in her life, entirely and wholly wanted. They married in the spring, in a quiet ceremony at Thornfield's Chapel, surrounded by the few people who had earned the right to call themselves family, Hawthorne, beaming with poorly hidden pride. Mrs. Whitfield, dabbing at her eyes with a handkerchief. Charlotte, finally free of the bitterness that had once defined her, smiling without a trace of envy for the first time in either of their lives. The chapel smelled of early lilac, and sunlight fell warm through narrow stained glass windows as Victoria walked the short aisle alone, by her own choice, having decided long ago that no one but herself would ever again determine the course of her life. William waited for her at the altar with an expression so open, so entirely undisguised, that several of the older guests would later remark they had never once believed the Duke of Thornfield capable of looking at anyone the way he looked at his bride that morning. "I, William, take you, Victoria," he said, his voice steady despite the emotion, plain in his eyes, "not as a debt repaid nor a rescue completed, but as the truest choice I have ever made of my own free will." Victoria, in turn, found her own voice steadier than she had ever imagined it could be, standing in a chapel full of people who finally, truly saw her. "I, Victoria, take you, William, knowing now what it means to be wanted rather than tolerated, chosen rather than endured. I will spend the rest of my life grateful that a carriage door opened on the very night I believed every door in the world had finally closed against me." Victoria Stirling, once cast into the mud by the only mother she had ever known, once told she was a mistake too small to matter, became Victoria, Duchess of Thornfield. Not because a duke had rescued her, but because two wounded souls had found in each other the particular kind of trust that neither had believed themselves capable of holding again. And on quiet evenings, when the fire burned low and the rain tapped soft against Thornfield's windows, William would sometimes find her standing near the entrance hall, looking toward the front door with a faint, private smile. "What are you thinking of?" he would ask. "The carriage door," she would always answer. "I am simply grateful it opened when it did." Sometimes, on those quiet evenings, William would draw her close and rest his chin lightly against the crown of her head, as they would stand together in silence, watching the rain trace soft lines down the window pane, no longer afraid of the storms that came, because they had learned, together, that some storms led somewhere worth surviving for. Belgrave House, in time, became a place of warmth rather than fear, its halls filled with Charlotte's careful new kindness and the quiet laughter of a household finally free of cruelty. Victoria visited often, never as the discarded girl who had once knelt in its mud, but as a woman who had reclaimed every room that had once tried to make her feel small. And always, whenever she returned to Thornfield afterward, William would be waiting at the door, the way he had waited that very first rainy night, not out of obligation, not out of duty, but simply because there was nowhere else in the world he wished to be. Years later, when their own children asked how their parents had met, Victoria would tell them the story slowly, carefully, leaving nothing out, the cruelty, the rain, the mud, the four quiet words that had changed everything. She wanted them to understand that a single act of kindness, offered without condition, could reach into the darkest night a person ever knew and pull them gently back into the light. And what happened to the wicked stepmother? Her eldest son would always ask, wide-eyed, at the end of the tale. She learned eventually that cruelty always finds its way back to the one who plants it, Victoria would answer. But that is a far smaller story than this one. This one is about a girl who was told she was unwanted, and a duke who proved, simply by opening a door, that she never was. Thank you so much for staying with us until the very end of this story. We hope Victoria and William's journey moved you, the way it moved us in the telling of it. If old Victorian England, duchesses, dukes, and tales of resilience and love speak to your heart, we would be deeply grateful if you considered subscribing to this channel, leaving a like, and sharing this story with someone who might need a little hope today. Tell us in the comments where in the world you are listening from. Your support means more to us than words can say. Until our next story, dear viewers, take care, and may your own carriage door open when you least expect it.